Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This week, WBUR's Edify team launched its series, Small Colleges, Big Challenges, which takes a look at how small private schools in New England are dealing with everything from financial woes to low enrollment to closures. In light of that, we wanted to take a look at the financial aid process, given that the 2020-2021 Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, rolled out this month. Experts stress that students and their families should file their FAFSAs as soon as possible, since financial aid in many states is awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. But it is not an easy process. So we've brought in two people familiar with the FAFSA to help us sift through it. Joining us now in Studio 3 is Rochelle Aranese, Director of Programs at Inversant, a nonprofit organization that helps send low-income students to college. Rochelle, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I should note that Bob Hildreth, the founder of Inversant, is a major donor to WBUR's Edify. Mm-hmm. Also with us is Peter Barros, Executive Director of La Vida Scholars, a nonprofit helping low-income, high-achieving students in Lynn. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
We very much want you as part of this conversation as well. Parents, students, are you completing the FAFSA and or the CSS profile? Have you done it in the past? What questions do you have? Or what do you wish you'd known back when you did it? For those going through the college application process for the first time, what do you want to know about the financial aid or college application and admissions process that we might be able to help with today? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, so Rochelle, the FAFSA opened this month, October 1st, kicking off one of the busiest times of the year for both of you, actually. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Let's start with you, Rochelle, at Inversant. How do you prepare for that, and what are you working on now?
Yes, of course. So we have a curriculum that we develop and make sure that it's updated whenever financial aid rules change or requirements for families and parents. So October is one of our busy months because of the fact that this is when we launch programming with all of our families. So not only is it, you know, the opening of applying for financial aid for our senior families, but this is the first time that we see our families after an entire summer break. Basically. So we do a lot of preparation. We make sure that, you know, our curriculum is intact. So what we do is we hold workshops across all of our high school partnerships. And in addition to some of the organizations that we partner with, including La Vida, and we speak to families about the ins and outs of how to apply for financial aid. Why is it important for every single family to apply, regardless of income or misconceptions that families may have? So this is a really busy month. We actually finished all of our workshops. We have about 5 or 6 throughout the entire month that we do.
So, Peter, what kinds of questions and areas of angst are families coming in with? I'm assuming your work would be somewhat similar to what we're hearing from Rochelle. So what do families need?
Yeah, for some context, I did a FAFSA about an hour and a half ago. I had a family member come in at like 10 a.m., I mean, to be honest, before you even start the process, I think families are already anxious. Like, the process in and of itself just stresses families out, I think.
I did the FAFSA this month, and I was sick to my stomach, the whole thing. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, especially for the families and students that we serve, right, they're first generation. This might, for them, they didn't handle it themselves, the family. So for most of my families, this is their first kid going off to college. They just feel confused and clueless. That's why the workshops are so important, to be able to introduce the, you know, show it to them, tell them what we're going to need. But I think the number one thing our families are just worried, am I going to get any money? Is my child going to be able to go to college? Or are we going to make a mistake? And I think that's why I advise the students to make sure, you know, they come to us first before we do the FAFSA, to not try to do it on your own.
Families shouldn't try to fill out the FAFSA alone if they have the option not to?
If there are resources out there, and there are a couple of resources, organizations that help families, even some of the high schools in some of the public school districts that we work with host kind of like a FAFSA day for their families to come in. So it's always good to have an expert there. But I would always recommend parent and student, if possible, to be there so that they can understand the ins and outs together.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What questions do you have about financial aid? Are you working on it with your own young adults right now? Have you worked on it in the past? Is there something you wish you knew that you think other people should? Do you know how to find resources to help you and your child at this important time? So there's this other thing. So it's not just FAFSA, right? We have alphabet letters all over the place. There's this other thing called the CSS profile, which, as I understand it, is administered by the College Board, not the federal government. It's a private nonprofit. How does it differ from FAFSA, and do families need to do both?
It depends on the student and the schools that they're applying to. CSS profile, for example, school like BU, I'm pretty sure, requires a CSS profile. In fact, I'm confident they do. It's mostly for some of the top tier elite private colleges that require me because they want a deeper dive into the family's financial aid and their financial circumstances. And
I think it's something like 200 colleges and universities.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
And so that's a great point. I'm glad you're really bringing that up. I think people think that FAFSA is the financial aid process. I would actually argue that FAFSA is easier, the easiest part sometimes. And not all students end up having to do a CSS profile, but it's a lot. Like I've told people before, I think CSS profile makes students have to jump through a hoop on fire, blindfolded backwards, because they really do ask for so many questions. You need to, and for some of our students and families, that means you need to sometimes, CSS requires you to disclose the non-custodial parent. And that can be really
tricky.
Meaning
if the parents are divorced or separated.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And for some families, that's pretty straightforward. You email a non-custodial parent. But for some of our families, right, that becomes a traumatic process, like, to be quite frank. Suddenly we're talking about, you know, if a parent's in another country, if a parent's been is incarcerated, if a parent is deceased, and you need to provide documentation to explain that situation. But CSS in general asks everything that the FAFSA does, but then it'll ask, you know, how much your rent is, medical, dental expenses, do you have other kids, how much are your expenses for those kids, do you have a car, do you rent, like it asks a lot of questions.
So, Rochelle, the first F in the acronym FAFSA stands for free. Yes. People can fill it out for free. The CSS profile, I think it's $25 for the first one and $16 for every school after that. I think the FAFSA allows you to automatically fill it out for 10 schools.
Exactly.
So is it advisable for any student who's applying to an institution that asks for both? Do you have to do either of them, and should you do them both?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on where the student is going to apply to. And I think a lot of universities and colleges do require it. So if a student, like Peter mentioned, were to apply to BU, for example, and BU requires the CSS profile for the child, they are going to have to fill out both the FAFSA and the CSS profile, which makes it, you know, very confusing for families, because we do tell them, you know, the major application that you have to fill out, it is free. But then when you get into college affordability, that's one of the things. Okay, so I have to pay for the application piece of applying to all of these colleges, and I have to pay also for the financial piece as well.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Lori from Concord, you're on the line. Go ahead, Lori. What's your question?
Yes, I'm Lori. My son is a sophomore, and he inherited some money from a grandparent who passed away last year. And I'm wondering if there's any thresholds in, at financial assets that would it even make sense to file FAFSAs? I mean, is there a point at which there's not a point in doing so?
Peter.
That's a great point. I think the one good thing is that he's a sophomore, so you have some time to get ready for that. What I will say, FAFSA made a huge change a few years ago where they moved it to October 1st, right? Forever, it was on January 1st. So what I will say is you have a good amount of time, but when you file your taxes your child's junior year, that's going to be the end all.
So I think her child is a sophomore in college.
Oh, in college.
Yeah.
Oh,
is that right, Lori? Are you still there?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And your son is a sophomore in college now?
Yes.
Okay. Lori still fill out the FAFSA for subsequent years?
I would say yes, because the colleges do require it, and if I'm assuming he's getting some kind of financial aid from the institution, the expectation is exactly, you don't just fill out FAFSA once and you're done. You have to keep renewing it even when you go off to college. But yes, to her point, that income, she has to report her income and her assets, and he has to report his income and assets, and that could essentially affect the calculation, the expected family contribution. That's what FAFSA. Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Rochelle.
What I would add to that, too, and Peter talked a little bit about it, too, is there's a lot of colleges and universities that to continue to provide you with sometimes even merit aid, they do require the families to fill out the FAFSA. So we do have a lot of families that are in the middle class, for example, income bracket, who ask that question, is it even worth it for me to do it? And we say, yes, there's a lot of universities that do require and won't even give you some types of financial aid if you don't actually do the FAFSA.
So keep the conversation going. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Helen from Marblehead, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm just calling in as a mom who's been through this process with two daughters who are now in their 30s, that remind parents that the money that they're getting for financial aid is usually the bulk of it is in a loan, and that these loans have to be repaid by the students once they graduate. And that can be really cumbersome to young people starting out their new lives. Just wanted to remind everybody to really think hard about where you send your child to school as far as what kind of debt they be incurring.
That's really helpful, Helen. And Peter and Rochelle, not all financial aid is created equal, right? Mm-hmm. That you may still take on significant financial burdens even if you receive aid. So how do you talk to families who come, let's say, to La Vida Scholars about how to grope their way through that decision-making process?
Well, I mean, it all comes down to whether it's need-based aid or merit-based aid. And I think every family and student's different. And students and families, well, it depends on the institution and how much you're going to get. I think at La Vida Scholars, we're working with our students to target the colleges that give the most generous need-based aid, colleges that meet 100% need. BU, for example, this year for the first time ever, is going to be meeting 100% need.
But that won't all be grants, right? That will be grants and loans?
And so all students get offered the $5,500 loan by the federal government. So students are offered that. And honestly, across the board, that's pretty
just
consistent.
Okay.
Some colleges like BU or these colleges that meet 100% need, they might have the student only take out 2,000 or 3,000 of that. But that's a very small percentage of colleges that have that policy. That's strategically what we do. I think to a point you made earlier, right? I think middle-income, middle-class families, they are the ones that tend to get, to be quite frank, screwed over the most because mm-hmm. they're not low-income enough to qualify for some of the great need-based aid, but they're not wealthy enough to have, $20,000 per year to contribute to college.
Okay, let's take another call. We've got Elizabeth from Westwood on the line. Elizabeth, go ahead.
I am recently widowed, applying for financial aid. Thank you for my oldest child, who is a senior in high school. My husband was the primary breadwinner. I do work, but make significantly less income than he did. I did receive a life insurance benefit, a one-time life insurance benefit, and just wondering if, that will be sitting in my bank account as an asset, obviously, and some of it was intended for college tuition, of course. But will I expect to just lose that, completely to college tuition?
Rochelle, what's your answer? What do you think for Elizabeth?
I would say we do have a lot of families that have unexpected circumstances happen. And one of the things that we tell families is even though you fill out FAFSA once a year, there is an appeal process, for example, that can happen where families can update the financial aid system. Something happened in family. I lost an income. This is what's going on. But in addition to that, yes, that's any sort of income that comes in or is lost is something that needs to be reported.
Isn't there a place in either form to explain extraordinary circumstances or your family circumstances, Peter?
So funny enough, FAFSA doesn't really give you a section to do that. CSS Profile does. And again, that's only for a few select colleges. But I think to the caller's point, remember the FAFSA is about getting your financial aid from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And then that in Massachusetts, that also goes to the state to get state funding. every college receives your expected family contribution, your FAFSA, and they make their own individual determination of how much they're going to give you, right? So a school like Harvard that has a super large endowment, they might be okay with it and be like, okay, we're still going to give you $40,000, right? Another college might be like, we're only going to give you $15,000. And so I think down the road, what we do with our students is come April, March, when the financial aid packages start coming in, right? That's when you can appeal directly to the college. But I wouldn't wait till then. I would reach out to the colleges as you're submitting your financial aid and let them know this is the circumstances, right? This is in some colleges, again, back in the day, colleges used to ask for a copy of your taxes. Like they wanted you to bring it in and submit a physical copy. So it depends by college, honestly, by college. So my advice to her would be to reach out to the colleges she's applying, to give them a heads up, so that she can provide those extenuating circumstances.
And Elizabeth, does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take another call. Maureen from Dedham, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Maureen.
Good afternoon.
The point I was calling to make is really just a reminder that even after you fill out the FAFSA, or even, you know, whatever extra loans you take, that there's always a fee that the college is going to charge you, and they'll put your student on hold in terms of getting their classes until that fee is paid. And just being a parent that's been through this with two students, those are things you don't know, and you think you've completed everything and you've got all your ducks in a row, and next thing you know, your child's calling you saying, I can't sign up for classes. I'm on hold. So those are just important little tidbits, you know, that you do not know until you've been through it.
Excellent. Thanks, Maureen. Thanks. So, Rochelle, how do you work with families about hidden costs and fee waivers and, you know, the College Board, and maybe we'll have time to get into this, they charge you for everything. How do you help families through that and not both get caught by surprise or not apply to schools that they want to or should because of the cost of applying?
Yes, of course. I think for us, we go over the different types of colleges and universities that are out there. And sometimes we get really to the nitty-gritty. For example, Salem State University, this is what an award letter looks like for Salem State, where they're supposed to list all of the costs. We talk to families about the fact that some of the costs that may be listed in that award letter may not be 100% transparent also. So sometimes we even send them, say, hey, the university's website is really, really helpful when it comes to this. Sometimes the cost that you see in the award letter may not necessarily reflect that for the year that you're thinking of. So we always send families to the university website to check out that. And we're honest with them and tell them about the fact that there are a lot of hidden costs and a lot of indirect costs that are not necessarily just the tuition, the room and board that you're going to be thinking. Even thinking about transportation, for example, if your child is going to be going to California, for example, for a university, thinking about a plane ticket, that's something that families sometimes don't really associate with the total cost of college. So we kind of go over the entire spectrum of everything that you need to think about when you're comparing how much a college or a university is going to cost you.
Peter, at the same time, what if the plane ticket to California is expensive, but you get a better package in some other ways? How should families think about things like being close to home or an in-state tuition versus a private tuition? It's not always obvious. How do you guide families through that?
Well, I think one of the things is, again, you're going to get the award letter once you're accepted to the college in the spring. And unfortunately, there is no universal award letter. And some colleges are really upfront and it's easy to understand. And then some colleges, it can be a little misleading, right? Some colleges will include a $2,000-$3,000 work study job as part of the financial aid package. I don't like to count that. And I tell students and I tell families, your child, because your child hasn't earned that money yet, right? Like when it's time to pay the bill before the child starts in September, do you have the $3,000? No, they got to actually go work and earn
it. Interesting.
So I find that misleading. So that's where we're able to help our students do that. I've given colleges that feedback that, you know, please don't do that. Mm-hmm. And then the big difference is, right, the direct costs versus the indirect costs. The reality is, you know, the analogy I'll say sometimes to the kids is, right, you got to, if you have a home, you got to pay for the mortgage, you got to pay for the electricity, you got to pay for the water. Right. You cannot. But the Wi-Fi, the cable, right, those are kind of like optional things. Like, you'll be able to live without those. So the direct costs are the tuition, fees, room and board, in the case of living on campus. You have to pay those. The indirect costs are transportation, books, all these other things. And colleges like to just estimate that sometimes. But listen, kids have gone even more creative in terms of books, right, and transportation. And those are the costs that you can manage little by little. So I think it's important to understand the cost that you actually have to pay, and then really understanding your aid. Again, and another great point, right, the loans, the fact that they are sometimes just thrown in. So many kids come to me with a financial aid award letter that says, look, I only got to pay $2,000 to go to this college. Mm-hmm. And there's a $14,000 Parent PLUS loan thrown in as part of the package, which technically the parent still has to apply and be approved for. It's not a given they're going
to
get it.
Oh, so Rochelle, to build on that, so they may even tell you about loans that you don't necessarily even have yet.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yes.
So what happens if a family applies for that loan and doesn't get it?
So for the most part, it depends on what kind of loan. So Parent PLUS loans are very lenient in terms of their requirements, and that actually makes it a little confusing for families because they think that this is a good loan. This is a student loan. This is something that probably has a low interest rate. But I would say Parent PLUS loans are one of the most predatory loans that are out there because of the fact that there's absolutely no sometimes there's no limit onto how much. So a parent can probably borrow $40,000, $50,000 in 1 year of their kid's college career and end up owing that much money. We've seen and I've heard of a lot of families that are going into retirement age with a good chunk of Parent PLUS loans.
Right.
So that's one of those things that also makes it very confusing.
Now, we had one more caller we're not going to have time for, but I did want to note that he works in higher ed and had called in to say, listen, you can also rely on the college financial aid offices. You can call and ask for help, and they'll provide help as well. All right, so we need our fast tips. Peter, if you were going to give one fast tip to families, what is it?
Oof, wow, put on the spot. I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm an accountant because I'm helping families guide through this financial aid process. So, I mean, one piece of advice is that before you get to senior year and junior year, make sure you are meeting with your own accountant when you're doing your own taxes to make sure you can line things up correctly there. Sometimes, you know, let's be honest, I meet with all kinds of situations, families where one mom is claiming they're separated, one's claiming two kids, one is claiming zero. And sometimes you got to be careful with how you do that.
All right, Rochelle, what's your quick, fast tip?
I would say start talking to your kids pretty early in terms of what their hopes and dreams are when it comes to the process so that the family is kind of like on the similar page at the very beginning and you can start looking at the different types of higher education, options that are out there.
Okay, Rochelle Aranese is the director of programs at Inversant. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Peter Bartos, Executive Director of La Vida Scholars, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, I just want to take a moment to let you know that tomorrow, Tuesday, Radio Boston will be hosting a special live 90-minute debate with all 8 of the Boston City Council at-large candidates. It will be at WBUR City Space. We'll ask the candidates about the biggest issues facing the city of Boston, affordable housing, education, the opioid crisis. It's part of our coverage this political season. It's produced as part of WBUR's longstanding partnership with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. The debate will air live right here on 90.9 WBUR at 2:30 tomorrow. We'll stream it online. Radio Boston will be a key host, but we'd actually love for you to join us at WBUR City Space. So for information on getting free tickets and actually coming in to attend, you can go to wbur.org/events. Stay with us. Coming up, we will speak to an author who discovered poetry in prison. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.